even to enjoy it. Blood blisters, fractures, cuts, concussions, they never affected his game. But this is different. Now two deep scratches on one hand are making him shoot his pucks high above the net. The front door is unlocked. Benji walks through the house and notices that apart from a mark on the door to the basement, the house looks like it always does, as if no one had ever lived there. He stands in the terrace doorway and watches Kevin spray pucks all over his neighbor's flower beds as if he were firing blind. Kevin's eyes are bloodshot and furious when they meet his. "There you are! I must have called you 1,000 times! "And now I'm here," Benji replies. "You need to answer when I call," Kevin snarls. Benji's words come slowly, his eyebrows lower threateningly. "I think you must be confusing me with Lit or Bobo. I'm not your slave. I answer when I feel like it." Kevin points at him with the tip of his stick. It's quivering with rage. "Have you finished taking drugs now, then? We're playing in the final next week, and everyone's acting like we've done enough just getting there. We need to get the guys together and make them all understand what I demand from them this week. So you need to be available. I won't tolerate the fact that when the team needs you most, you vanish in a puff of smoke." Benji doesn't know if he means puff of smoke as a joke or if Kevin's too stupid to appreciate the double meaning. It's always hard to tell with Kevin. He's both the smartest and stupidest person Benji knows. "You know why I left the party," Kevin snorts. "Yeah, because you're a fucking saint, right?" Benji's eyes stare at Kevin's, intently and without looking away. When Kevin eventually averts his gaze and looks away, his friend asks, "What happened last night, Kev?" Kevin lets out a curt laugh and throws his arms out. "Nothing. Everyone was drunk. You know what it's like." "What happened to your hand?" "Nothing. I saw Maya in the forest. It didn't look like nothing." Kevin spins around as if he were about to hit Benji with his stick. His lips are quivering, his pupils burning. "So now you give a damn? What the hell does it matter to you anyway? You weren't even here. You'd rather go to head and get wasted than stay here with your best friends, your team." Benji's eyes are staring intently at the way Kevin's are moving. Kevin looks away again, fires a puck so high above the net that it should be recategorized as a hunting weapon, and mumbles, "I needed you yesterday." Benji doesn't answer, which always makes Kevin lose his temper with him, and he roars, "You weren't here, Benji! You're never here when I need you! Lit was sick all over the fucking kitchen, and someone banged into the cellar door and left a huge mark on it. Have you got any idea what's gonna happen when my dad gets home and sees it? Do you have any idea? Or have you smoked away all..." "I don't give a shit about your dad. I want to know what happened last night," Benji interrupts. Kevin takes 5 quick steps and breaks his stick on the top of the goal, and it snaps into 2 razor-sharp projectiles, one of which misses Benji's face by a hand's width. But he doesn't blink. "Really? You don't give a shit about my dad's... You ungrateful fucking... Who's been paying for your skates and sticks and gear for the past 10 years? Didn't you give a shit about him then either? Do you think your mom could have afforded all that? Christ, my dad's right about you. He's always been right about you. You're a virus, Benji. A fucking virus. You can't live without some sort of host." Benji takes 2 steps forward. Just 2. His face is expressionless. "What happened last night, Kev?" "What do you want? Is this some fucking police interrogation? What's your problem?" "Don't be a coward, Kev." "You want to lecture me about being a coward? You want to talk about cowardice? For fuck's sake, you're the one who's a fucking... Benji moves so fast that Kevin breathes the last words into his face. Their eyes are just a few inches from each other's. Benji's are wide open. "What? What am I, Kev? Tell me." Kevin's skin is pulsating, his eyes running, his neck is red and blue on one side as if he's been punched hard by someone with small hands. He backs away and picks up part of the broken stick and slams it into the goal, making the metal sing. "Get out of my house, Ovich. You've sponged off my family for long enough." He doesn't turn around to watch Benji go, nor when he hears the front door slam shut. They get home late. The house looks like it did when they left it. Their son is pretending to be asleep. They don't knock on his door. Kevin's father finds two sheets of paper on the kitchen counter on which Kevin has given a careful account of all the statistics of each period of the game. Minutes played, shots, assists, goals, numerical superiority and inferiority, possession, penalties, mistakes. His father spends a couple of minutes sitting in the glow of a single lamp and smiles in a way that he doesn't let anyone see anymore. So proud. A man with less impulse control would have gone upstairs and kissed his sleeping son on his forehead. His mother notices things that his father misses. She sees the pictures that the cleaner has mixed up and hung in the wrong order, the table that is slightly askew in the living room, a scrap of the plastic covering that has caught beneath one corner of the sofa. But above all, she sees the mark on the cellar door. While her husband is sitting in the kitchen, she takes a deep breath and slams her suitcase into it as hard as she can. He comes running and she apologizes, saying she tripped and let go of the case. He helps her up and holds her and whispers, "Don't look so upset. It's only the cellar door. It's just a little mark, darling." Then he shows her the sheets of paper and says, "They won." She laughs into his shirt. Chapter 24. When the burglar alarm goes off at the school early on Monday morning, the security company doesn't call the police, because it could take them hours to get there. They call one of the teachers instead. Not any teacher, they call the one whose little brother works for the security firm, so that her brother won't have to go to the trouble of fetching his own keys. Jeanette gets out of her car in the deserted parking lot, pulls up the collar of her coat, and blinks tiredly. "Sometimes you're so lazy I'm starting to think your kids must be adopted." Her brother laughs. "Come on, sis, stop whining. You're the one who always says I don't call you often enough." She rolls her eyes, takes his flashlight off him, and unlocks a side door to the school. "It's probably just snow that slid off the roof onto the sensors around the back again." They go into the corridor without turning the lights on, because if anyone has broken in, the lights will have come on automatically in that section. But what sort of idiot would break into a school on a Monday morning? Benji is woken by a bright light, even though the lamps in the ceiling are already on. His back aches. His mouth tastes of moonshine and cheap beer nuts, which troubles him because he has no memory of having eaten beer nuts. He blinks sleepily, holds up his hand, and tries to squint at the person who's shining a light in his eyes. "You've got to be kidding," the teacher sighs. Benji pushes himself into a sitting position on top of the two desks he's been sleeping on in the classroom. He throws his arms out like the world's most exhausted magician. "The headmaster did tell me I needed to start showing up on time in the morning, so, ta-da! Actually, what time is it?" He feels his pockets. Can't find his watch. His fractured memories of the previous night suggest that he may well have drunk that away, too. Precisely what train of thought led him to conclude his little odyssey trying various substances with a break-in at his school is also a little vague in hindsight, but he's sure it must have seemed a superb idea at the time. The teacher leaves him without a word, and he sees her talking with a security guard out in the corridor. The guard will write this off as a false alarm, seeing as brothers do what their big sisters tell them, no matter how old they get. The teacher comes back into the classroom and opens two windows to air out the room. She sniffs at Benji's jacket and makes a face. "Please don't tell me you've brought drugs into the school." Benji does a poor job of wagging his finger at her. "It would never even occur to me. Drugs in school are no good. I keep my drugs in my body. Do you want to dance?" He falls off the desk with a giggle and lands on the floor on his back. The teacher crouches down beside him and looks at him somberly until he falls silent. Then she says, "If I report this to the headmaster, he'll have to suspend you, maybe even expel you from school. And shall I tell you something, Benjamin? Sometimes I think that's what you want. It's as if you're trying to prove to the whole world that there's nothing in your life that you aren't destructive enough to have a go at wrecking." Benji doesn't answer. She hands him his jacket. I'm going to switch the alarm off. Then I'm going to let you into the gym so you can have a shower. To be honest, you smell so terrible that I should probably call pest control as well. Have you got any clean clothes in your locker? He tries to smile when she helps him up. So that I look presentable when the headmaster arrives? She sighs. I'm not going to report you. You're going to have to ruin your life on your own. I'm not going to help you. He meets her gaze and nods gratefully. Then his voice suddenly becomes adult, his eyes a man's instead of a boy's. I'm sorry I called you sweet cheeks. That was disrespectful. I won't do it again. Nor will anyone else on the team. He rubs his neck, and Jeanette almost regrets telling the truth when she met up with Audrey at the pub in Head and was asked what his behavior in school was like. But she knows he's telling the truth when he says that no one on the team will call her that again, and she wonders how he has come to have such authority over the others. That a single word from Benji can make any hockey player in the entire school start or stop doing anything. It almost makes her miss playing the game herself. She and Audrey were childhood friends, and they used to play together over in Head. Sometimes she feels that both she and Audrey stopped too soon, and wonders what would have happened if there had been a girls' team in Beartown. Go and shower, she says, patting Benji's hand. Yes, miss, he smiles, his eyes a boy's again. I'm not hugely fond of being called miss, either, she grunts. What would you like to be called, then? Jeanette. Jeanette will do absolutely fine. She fetches a towel for him from the gym bag in her car, and he follows her to the gym. After she switched the alarm off and unlocked the door for him, he stands in the opening and says, You're a good teacher, Jeanette. You just had really bad timing, getting us in your class when we were at our best. At that moment, she understands why the team follows his lead. The same reason why the girls fall for him. When he looks you right in the eyes and says something, no matter what crap he may have done immediately before, you believe him. Kevin's dad knots his tie, adjusts his cufflinks, and picks up his briefcase. At first, he considers calling goodbye to his son from the door like he usually does, but he changes his mind and goes out through the terrace door instead. He puts his briefcase down and picks up a stick. They stand side by side and take turns firing shots. It must be 10 years since the last time. I bet you can't hit the post, his dad says. Kevin raises his eyebrows as if it's a joke. When he sees that it isn't, he pulls the puck back a couple of inches, flexes his wrists gently, and sends the puck flying into the metal. His dad taps his stick on the ground approvingly. Luck? Good players deserve luck, Kevin replies. He learned that when he was little. His dad has never let him win so much as a table tennis match in the garage. Did you see the statistics from the match? The boy asks hopefully. His dad nods and looks at his watch, walks toward his briefcase. I hope you don't imagine that the final is an excuse for you not to put 100% into your schoolwork this week. Kevin shakes his head. His dad almost touches his cheek, almost asks about the red marks on his neck. But instead he clears his throat and says, People in this town are going to try to stick to you more than usual now, Kevin. So you need to remember that viruses make you sick. You need to be immune to them. And the final isn't just about hockey. It's about what sort of man you want to be. A man who goes out and grabs what he deserves, or one who stands in a corner waiting for someone to give it to him. The father walks off without waiting for a reply, and his son stands there with scratch marks on his hand and a heartbeat that won't stop throbbing in his neck. His mom is waiting in the kitchen. Kevin stares at her uncertainly. There's freshly made breakfast on the table. A smell of bread. Well, it's probably a bit silly, but I took this morning off, she says. What for? Kevin wonders. I thought we could spend some time together, just you and me. I thought we could talk. He avoids her gaze. She looks a little too desperate for him to be able to handle eye contact. I have to go to school, Mom. She nods, her teeth biting into her lower lip. Yes, yes, of course. It was silly. I'm silly. She feels like going after him and asking a million questions. Late last night, she found sheets in the dryer, and he's never washed so much as a sock for himself before. There was a t-shirt there, too, with bloodstains that hadn't quite come out. When he was in the garden this morning firing pucks, she went into his room, found the blouse button on the floor. She wants to go after him, but she doesn't know how to talk to an almost grown man through a closed bathroom door. She packs her briefcase and gets in her car and drives half an hour into the forest before stopping. She sits there all morning, so that no one at work will ask why she's there so early, because she told them she was going to be spending the morning with her son. Kira is standing with her hand against the door of Maya's room, but she doesn't knock again. Her daughter has already said she's ill, and Kira doesn't want to be that mother. The nagging, uncool, anxious helicopter parent. She doesn't want to knock again to ask if there's actually something else wrong. You can't do that. Nothing makes a 15-year-old girl clam up more than the words, "Do you want to talk?" You can't just open the door and ask why she has suddenly started washing her own clothes of her own volition. After all, what is Kira, the Secret Service? So Kira does the not nagging, not anxious, not helicopter, cool mom thing. She gets in her car and drives off. 45 minutes into the forest, she stops the car, sits there alone in the darkness, and waits for the pressure on her chest to subside. Lit opens the door and looks like he's just seen a cake.
Kevin! Hi! What?
Kevin nods at him impatiently. Ready? Kevin asks.
For what?
School? Now? With you?
You mean, do I want to walk to school? With you?
Are you ready or not?
Where's Benji?
Fuck Benji, Kevin snaps. Lit stands there in shock with his mouth open, unable to think of anything to say. Kevin rolls his eyes impatiently.
Are you waiting for communion or what? Shut your mouth for fuck's sake, let's go.
Lit stumbles off and hurries to make sure he's got his shoes on the right feet and his outdoor clothes at least relatively close to the appropriate body parts. Kevin doesn't say a word all the way, until his outsized teammate grins and pulls out a 100-kroner note.
So do I owe you this or not?
He starts giggling uncontrollably when Kevin takes it. Kevin tries to look nonchalant as he says, but keep your mouth shut about it, okay? You know what women are like. Lit has never looked more euphoric than when he was given the chance to share a secret with his team captain. Maya's phone rings, and she wishes with all her soul that it might be Anna, but it's Ahmet again. She hides the phone under her pillow as if she were trying to smother it. She doesn't know what to say to him, and she knows that Ahmet will primarily be wishing he hadn't seen anything at all. If she doesn't answer the phone, maybe the two of them can find some way of pretending that nothing happened, that it was just a misunderstanding. She removes the batteries from all the fire alarms and opens all the windows before putting her blouse on the floor of the shower and setting light to it. Then she sets light to a carton of cereal, letting the top burn before putting it out and leaving the remains on the kitchen counter. When her mom, a woman with the nose of a hungry grizzly bear, comes home and wonders why there's a smell of smoke, the explanation will be that Maya managed to knock the carton of cereal onto a lit burner on the stove. She carefully sweeps up the remains of the blouse from the shower, and only then does she realize that the buttons have melted and stuck to the drain, and the synthetic material hasn't turned to ash the way she had hoped. If Anna had been there, she would have said, "Shit, Maya, if I ever murder anyone, remind me not to ask you for help." She misses her. God, how she misses her. For several minutes, she sits on the bathroom floor crying and trying to make herself phone her best friend. But she can't do that to her. Can't drag her into this. Can't force her to carry this secret. It takes more than an hour to clean the bathroom and get rid of the remains of the burned blouse. She puts them in a plastic bag, stands shaking in the doorway, and stares at the garbage bin 10 yards away. It's light outside now, but that doesn't make any difference. She's scared of the darkness in the middle of the day. Chapter 25. Anna is walking to school alone, holding her phone in her hand like a weapon. Maya's number on the screen, her finger on the button, but she doesn't call. The most important promise they made was never to leave each other, not because of safety, but because the promise made them equals. They've never been equals in any other way. Maya still has two parents, a brother, a home that doesn't smell of cigarettes and vodka. She's smart, funny, popular, gets better grades. She's musical, brave. She can get better friends. And she gets guys. If Anna left Maya alone in the wilderness, Maya would die. But what she didn't realize when she left Maya alone at a party was that it amounted to the same thing. Anna keeps her finger on the button, but doesn't call. In a few years' time, she'll read an old newspaper article about research showing that the part of the brain that registers physical pain is the same part that registers jealousy. And then Anna will understand why she hurt so badly. Ahmet and Fatima are standing at the bus stop as usual, but nothing else is the same. When Fatima was out shopping yesterday, everyone said hello to her. When she went to the cash register, Tails, who owns the whole store, came over and tried to give her everything free of charge. She didn't let him, of course, no matter how wealthy he was, and in the end, the huge man threw up his hands and said with a chuckle, "You're as stubborn as winter. I can see where Ahmet gets it from." His white car is coming along the road now, a couple of minutes ahead of the bus. He stops and says he's been to one of his other stores and just happened to be passing. Fatima doesn't know if it's true. At first, she declines his offer of a lift to the rink, but changes her mind when she sees the way Ahmet is looking at the car. Tails is driving, Fatima is sitting in the passenger seat, and in the rearview mirror, she can see how proud that makes her son. That he has been able to make this happen. As the boy practices on his own that morning, Tails sits in the stands alongside the A-team coach and the GM. When Fatima goes into the club president's office to empty the trash can, the president stands and picks it up off the floor for her, shakes her hand. The school corridor is already full of people when the boys walk in. Everyone turns to look at them, and Lit has never been so happy that Benji isn't around. The attention from people who think he's Kevin's new best friend is dizzying. That's why he doesn't react when Kevin mutters that he needs to shit, goes into one of the bathrooms. His old best friend would have known that Kevin never does that at school if he can possibly help it. Inside, in the dark, Kevin tears the 100-kroner note into tiny pieces and flushes them down the toilet. He doesn't switch the light on, doesn't look at himself in the mirror. Ahmet catches up with Zacharias at the lockers. They haven't seen each other since the game, and only now does it occur to Ahmet that perhaps he should have called. When he sees the disappointment and anger in Zacharias's eyes, he realizes he should have done more than that. "Hi. Sorry about Saturday. Everything happened so fast. Zacharias slams his locker shut and shakes his head. "I get it. Team party. With your new team." "Look, that's not what I meant," Ahmet says, but Zacharias doesn't let him get as far as an apology. "It's okay, Ahmet. You're a star now. I get it." "Come on, Zach. My dad said to congratulate you." This last remark hurts Zacharias most of all. His dad works at the factory. Everyone loves hockey there. Because the team was founded by factory workers, they still feel that it belongs to them. Zacharias would have done any number of ridiculous things to be able to send his dad off to work as the father of a junior team player. The fact that his son is friends with one of them was enough to put a smile on his dad's face all the way there. Ahmet swallows the words he feels like saying and tries to find others instead, but doesn't have time before Zacharias's cap flies off his head and his body thuds into the lockers. Two final-year pupils, whose names Ahmet doesn't know, laugh loudly. "Oops, didn't see you," one of them grins. "That must be the first time someone hasn't seen you, eh, Fatty? How much have you eaten? Another fat kid?" The other one leers, pinching Zacharias's stomach. This sort of thing happens to Zacharias a lot. It's been going on for years,
So the shock, for all concerned, is almost unimaginable when he suddenly flashes forward and headbutts one of them in the chest as hard as he can. The older boy staggers as if a sandbag had just hit back, and it takes a moment for him to come to his senses. But then his fist smashes straight into Zacharias's mouth. Amit cries out and throws himself between them. The two final year pupils evidently don't go to hockey matches because they don't hesitate to knock him to the floor. What do we got here then, a little terrorist? You're from the Hollow, aren't you? Amit says nothing. The older boy goes on. There's nothing but terrorists and fucking camels in the Hollow. Is that where you're from? Amit doesn't answer back. He's had a whole lifetime to learn that it only makes things worse. One of the older boys drags him up by his top and snarls, I said, where do you come from? No one has a chance to react. The noise when the back of a head hits a locker is so deafening that at first Amit thinks it must be his. Bobo picks one of the final year pupils off the floor. Even though he's a year older than Bobo, he must be at least 20 pounds lighter. Bobo's voice is on fire when he clarifies. Beartown. His name is Amit, and he's from Beartown. The older boy's eyes flit about until Bobo lets go of him, only to slam the back of his head into the locker again. With his face pressed up against the older boy's, he asks, Where's he from? Beartown! Beartown! Fuck! It was only a joke, Bobo! Bobo lets go of him, and he and his friend run off. Bobo helps Amit up and tries to hold out his hand to Zacharias, too, but Zacharias brushes it aside. Bobo says nothing. Thanks, Amit says. You're one of us now. No one touches us, Bobo smiles. Amit looks at Zacharias. There's blood seeping from his friend's nose. I've got a class. See you at lunch. Everyone on the team always sits at the same table. Come and find us, Bobo interrupts, then disappears. Amit nods as he walks off. When he turns around, Zacharias has already taken his jacket and bag from his locker and is heading for the exit. What the hell, Zach? Wait! Come on, he helped you! Zacharias stops but doesn't turn around. He refuses to let Amit see his tears when he says, No, he helped you! So run along, big shot. Your new team is waiting for you. The door closes after him. Amit's conscience and a sense of guilt and injustice wash over him. If he hadn't been so worried about getting injured and missing the final, he would have slammed his fist into one of the lockers. He picks up his phone from the floor. Calls no one. Benji is on his way to the classroom, but he happens to pass the bathrooms just as Kevin emerges from one of the cubicles, and it throws him off balance like an elbow from out of nowhere. Kevin hurries past, but Benji stops dead. He's not easily surprised, but he's left standing with his mouth half open and his eyes half closed. Kevin avoids looking at him, as if he didn't exist. As long as the two friends can remember, anyone who has seen them play has said that they seem to be on the same wavelength, a secret frequency that only they can access. They don't need to look at each other on the ice to know where the other is. Neither of them has ever been able to put it into words, but whatever it was, there's nothing but static now. Kevin brushes the wall of the corridor, sheltered by lit, and the other juniors automatically fall in on all sides. Benji has never known who he would have been if he didn't have his team, but he's starting to realize that he's about to find out now. When Kevin, Lit, Bobo, and the others go into the classroom, Benji stands outside, trying hard not to prove to the whole world that there is nothing in his life that he isn't destructive enough to have a go at wrecking. He really does try. When Jeanette takes attendance, she looks out of the window and sees Benji light a cigarette in the schoolyard, get on his bicycle, and ride off. The teacher hesitates for a moment. Then she marks him as present anyway. Anna turns up the brightness of the screen to maximum, opens all her apps, and starts a film before leaving her phone in her locker. She treats herself like an alcoholic emptying her home of bottles. She knows that before the morning is over, she won't be able to resist calling Maya any longer. She wants to make sure that the battery will be exhausted by then,
making it impossible. It doesn't matter who sits together that day. Everyone eats lunch on their own. Chapter 26. Peter is sitting on a bench in the junior's empty locker room. One of the posters with a quote meant to inspire has fallen to the floor. It's crumpled and marked with footprints. Peter reads it over and over again. He can remember when Soon pinned it up. Peter had only just learned to read. He had been a child heading straight into darkness when hockey found him. Soon dragged him to the surface, and this team kept him afloat. With a mom who died when he was in primary school and a dad who was always teetering on the brink between happy drunk and cruel alcoholic, when Peter as a little boy found something to cling on to, he held on until his knuckles turned white. Soon was always there, through the wins and the losses, in Beartown and on the other side of the world. When the injuries piled up and his career came to an abrupt halt, when Peter buried his father and his son within the space of a year, it was Soon who called him then and told him there was a club here that needed help, and Peter needed to feel that he could keep something alive. He knows how quiet it gets when hockey tells you you're finished. How quickly you start to miss the ice, the locker room, the guys, the bus trips, the gas station sandwiches. He knows how as a 17-year-old he would look at the tragic former players in their 40s who used to hang around the rink, going on about their own achievements in front of an audience that got smaller and smaller each season. The job of GM gave him a chance to live on as part of a team, to build something bigger, something that could outlast him. But with that came responsibility. Make the difficult decisions. Live with the pain. He picks up the poster that's fallen to the floor, reads it one last time. A great deal is expected of anyone who's been given a lot. Today he will persuade the man who dragged him to the surface to resign of his own free will. The sponsors and the board don't even want to fire Soon. They don't want to give him a redundancy payoff. Peter is expected to tell him to leave in silence, because that would be best for the club. Soon wakes early in the little row house where he's always lived on his own. He rarely has visitors, but those who do come are often surprised by how tidy it is. No piles of clutter, newspapers, beer cans, and pizza boxes, as some people might expect of an old man who has been a bachelor all his life. Neat. Tidy. Clean. Not even any hockey posters on the walls or trophies on the shelves. Soon has never been very fond of objects. He has his plants in the windows, and during the summer recess, he grows flowers in the narrow garden at the back. And the rest of the time, he has hockey. He drinks his instant coffee and washes the cup straight afterward. He was once asked what the most important requirement was if he wanted to become a successful hockey coach. He replied, "Being able to drink really bad coffee." All those early mornings and late nights in rinks with scorched coffee pots and cheap coffee machines, bus trips and isolated roadside cafes, camps and tournaments with school refectories. How could anyone with an expensive espresso machine at home ever put up with that? You want to be a hockey coach? Get used to not having the things other people have. Free time, a family life, decent coffee. Only the toughest of men can handle this sport. Men who can drink terrible coffee cold, if need be. He walks through the town, says hello to almost all the men over 30. At some point over the years, he's coached pretty much every single one of them. The teenagers are a different matter altogether, because each year he recognizes fewer and fewer of them. He no longer shares a language with the boys in this town, which makes him as obsolete as a fax machine. He doesn't actually understand how he's expected to believe that children are the future, when more and more of them are choosing not to play hockey. How can you be a child and not want to play hockey? He takes the road leading up through the forest, and when he reaches the turning to the kennels, he sees Benjamin. The boy stubs his cigarette out too late to avoid being seen, but Soon pretends not to have noticed. When he himself was a player, his teammates used to smoke in the breaks between periods, and some of them would drink export-strength beer. Times change, but he isn't sure that the game has actually changed quite as much as some coaches think. He stops by the fence and looks at the dogs rushing about. The long-haired boy stands beside him, uncomprehendingly, but doesn't ask what he's doing there. Soon pats him lightly on his shoulder. Fantastic game on Saturday, Benjamin. Fantastic game. Benji looks down at the ground and nods silently. Soon doesn't know if it's shyness or humility, so the old man points through the fence and adds, "You know, when David first became a coach, I always used to say to him that the best hockey players are like the best hunting dogs. They're born egotists. They always hunt for their own sake. So you need to nurture them and train them and love them until they start hunting for your sake, too. For their teammates' sake. Only then can they become really good. Truly great." Benji brushes his bangs from his eyes. "Are you thinking of getting one, then?" "I've been thinking about it for years, but I always thought I didn't have time for a puppy." Benji puts his hands in his jacket pockets and stamps some snow from his shoes. "And now?" Soon starts laughing. "I have a feeling that I might have a bit more free time than I'm used to fairly soon." Benji nods and looks him in the eye for the first time in the conversation. "Just because we love David doesn't mean that we wouldn't have played for you." "I know," the old man replies, and pats the boy on the shoulder again. Soon doesn't say what he's thinking, because he isn't sure if it would actually do Benjamin any favors. But the whole time David and Soon have been arguing about whether a 17-year-old could be ready to play in the A-team, they've really always been in total agreement. Just not about which of the 17-year-olds it should be. Kevin may have the natural talent, but Benjamin has all the rest. Soon has always been more interested in the length of the string than the size of the balloon. Audrey comes out of the house, ruffles her little brother's hair, and shakes Soon's hand. "I'm Soon," he says. "I know who you are," Audrey replies, then asks immediately, "What do you think about next season? Have we got a chance of going up? You need to get a couple of decent skaters into that team, surely. Get rid of the donkeys in the second and third lines." It takes Soon a few moments to realize that she's talking about the A-team and not the juniors. He's so used to the juniors' relatives only wanting to talk about the junior team that it catches him off guard. "There's always a chance, but the puck doesn't just glide," Soon says. "It bounces as well," Audrey grins. When Soon looks bemused, Benji explains helpfully. "Audrey used to play in head. She's rough as hell, got more penalties than me." Soon laughs appreciatively. Audrey gestures toward the fence. "So what can we do for you?" "I'd like to buy a dog," Soon says. Audrey holds out her hand and presses his shoulder with a stern face but a friendly smile. "I'm afraid I can't let you buy one, Soon. But I can give you one. For building up this club. And for saving my little brother's life." Benji is breathing through his nose and concentrating on the dogs. Soon's lips quiver gently. When he's composed himself, he manages to say, "So, which puppy would you recommend for a retired old guy, then?" "That one," Benji says, pointing at one without hesitation. "Why?" Now it's the boy's turn to pat the old man on the shoulder. "Because he's a challenge." David is sitting on his own in the stands in the rink. For once, he's looking up at the roof, not down at the ice. He's got a migraine, is under more pressure than ever. Can't remember the last time he slept right through the night. His girlfriend can't even be bothered to try communicating with him at home anymore, seeing as she never gets any response. He's living inside his own head, and in there, he's on the ice 24 hours a day. In spite of that, or perhaps precisely because of it, he can't take his eyes off the worn old banner hanging above his head. Culture, values, community. He's due to give an interview to the local paper today. The sponsors have arranged it. David protested, but the club's president just grinned.
You want the media to write less about you? Tell your team to play worse.
He can already imagine all the questions.
What is it that makes Kevin Erdahl so good? They'll ask. And David will reply the way he always replies.
Talent and training. 10,000 little things that he's repeated 10,000 times.
But that isn't really true. He'll never be able to explain it properly to a journalist. But when it really comes down to it, a coach can never create a player like that. Because what makes Kevin the best is his absolute desire to win. Not that he hates losing, but that he can't even begin to conceive of trying to accept not winning. He's merciless. You can't teach someone that. How many hours did these guys put into it? How much did David himself sacrifice? Their whole lives up to the age of 20, 25 are nothing but training, training, training. And what do they get for that if it turns out that they're not good enough? Nothing. No education, no safety net. A player who's as good as Kevin is might turn professional, might earn millions. And the players who are almost as good? They'll end up in the factory just the other side of the trees from the rink. David looks at the banner. As long as his team carries on winning, he'll have a job here. But if they lose? How many steps away from the factory is he? What can he do apart from hockey? Nothing. He was sitting in this precise spot when he was 22, thinking exactly the same things. Soon was sitting beside him, then. David asked about the banner, asked what it meant to Soon, and Soon replied, "Community is the fact that we work toward the same goal, that we accept our respective roles in order to reach it. Values is the fact that we trust each other, that we love each other." David thought about that for a long while before asking, "What about culture, then?" Soon looked more serious, choosing his words carefully. In the end, he said, "For me, culture is as much about what we encourage as what we actually permit." David asked what he meant by that, and Soon replied, "That most people don't do what we tell them to. They do what we let them get away with." David closes his eyes, clears his throat. Then he stands up and walks down toward the ice. Doesn't look up at the roof again. Banners have no meaning this week. Only results. Peter passes the president's office. It's full of people, even though it's still morning. Enthusiastic sponsors and board members are abuzz. One of the board members, a man in his 60s who made his money in 3 different construction companies, is making wild, thrusting movements with his hips to illustrate what he thinks Beartown did to their opponents in the semifinal, then yelps, "And the whole third period was one big orgasm. They came here thinking they were going to fuck us. They won't be able to put their legs together for weeks." Some of the men laugh, some don't. If any of them is thinking anything, they don't say it. Because it's only a joke, after all, and the board members are like a team. You take the good with the bad. Later that day, Peter will drive to the big supermarket owned by Tails. He'll sit in his old friend's office and talk rubbish about old matches, telling the same jokes they've told since they first met in skating class when they were 5 years old. Tails will want to offer whiskey, Peter will decline, but before he leaves, he'll say, "Have you got any jobs in the warehouse?" Tails will scratch his stubble hesitantly and wonder, "Who for?" "Robbie." "I've got a waiting list of 100 people who want warehouse jobs. Which Robbie are you talking about?" Peter will stand up and cross Tails' office to an old photograph hanging on the wall. A photograph of a hockey team from a small town in the forest who got to be second best in the country. First, Peter will point at himself in the photograph, then at Tails, and then, in between the two of them, at Robbie Holtz. "We look after each other, isn't that what you said, Tails? The Bears from Beartown." Tails will look at the photograph and lower his chin in shamefaced agreement. "I'll check with personnel." 2 men in their 40s will shake hands in front of a picture of themselves in their 20s. The locker room fills with juniors without filling with noise. They put their gear on in silence.
Benji doesn't show up. Everyone notices. No one says anything.
Lit makes a half-hearted attempt to break the silence by telling them how he got a blowjob from a girl at Kevin's party, but when he won't say who the girl was, it becomes obvious that he's lying. Everyone knows Lit can't keep a secret.
Lit looks as if he wants to say something else, but glances toward Kevin with an anxious look on his face and says nothing.
The players move out toward the ice. Lit tapes his pads and tears the loose scraps of tape and throws them on the floor.
Bobo waits until almost all the others have left the locker room before bending over, picking them up, and dropping them in the garbage. He and Amit never talk about it.
They're halfway through the training session before Kevin finds a way to end up close enough to Amit during a break in play to be able to talk without being overheard. Amit is leaning forward on his stick, staring at his skates.
"What you think you saw," Kevin begins.
He's not threatening, not hard or commanding. He's almost whispering. You know what women are like. Amit wishes he knew what he is supposed to say. Wishes he had the courage. But his lips remain sealed. Kevin pats him gently on the back.
"We're gonna make a fucking good team, you and me.
In the A-team." He glides away toward the bench when Lars blows his whistle. Amit follows, still staring at his skates but unable to look right at the ice, frightened of seeing his reflection in it. Chapter 27. The lump in Kira's stomach refuses to give up its grasp. She keeps telling herself that there's nothing wrong with Maya, that she's just a normal teenager, that it's just a phase. She keeps telling herself to be the cool mom. It's not working. So when her colleague blunders in through the door, Kira feels grateful rather than annoyed. Even though she's got an ocean of work to drown herself in, she's relieved to see her standing there shouting that she needs help crushing these bastards.
"Didn't this client agree to a settlement?"
Kira asks as she scans the document her colleague tosses onto her desk.
"That's the problem. They want me to back down, like some sort of coward. And you know what the badger says?"
"Do as the client said," Kira suggests.
"Do as the client says. That's what he says. Can you believe that he's in charge? In charge. What is it with men? Have they got a different density from women or what? How come anyone with a dick always rises to the top of every single organization?"
"Okay, but if your client accepts the terms, then..."
"Then that's my job? Go to hell! Isn't it my job to look after my client's best interests?"
Kira's colleague is bouncing up and down with anger, her heels leaving little marks in the floor of the office. Kira rubs her forehead.
"Well, yes, but maybe not if the client doesn't actually want you to." "My clients have no idea what they want."
Kira looks at the document, sees the name of the firm representing the other party, and starts to laugh. Her colleague applied for a job there once and didn't get it.
"Okay, but the fact that you want to win this particular case, that wouldn't be because you just happen to hate this particular firm," Kira mutters.
Her colleague grabs her over the desk, her eyes flashing.
"No, I don't just want to win, Kira. I want to crush them. I want to give them an existential crisis. I want them to walk out of the negotiation room and think that they might like to move to the coast and renovate an old school and open a bed and breakfast. I want to hurt those bastards so badly that they start meditating and trying to find themselves. They'll turn vegetarian and be wearing socks with sandals by the time I'm finished with them."
Kira sighs and laughs.
"Okay, okay, okay. Give me the rest of the file and let's take a look." "Socks with sandals, Kira. I want them to start growing their own tomatoes. I want to ruin their self-confidence until they stop being lawyers and try to be happy and shit like that instead, okay?"
Kira promises. They close the door.
They're going to win.
They always do. Peter closes the door behind him, sits down at his desk, stares at the resignation papers that are waiting for Soon's signature. If Peter has learned one thing about human nature during all his years in hockey, it's that almost everyone regards themselves as a good team player, but that very few indeed understand what that really means. It's often said that human beings are pack animals,
And that thought is so deeply embedded that hardly anyone is prepared to admit that many of us are actually really rubbish at being in groups. That we can't cooperate, that we're selfish, or worst of all, that we're the sort of people other people just don't like. So we keep repeating, I'm a good team player. Until we believe it ourselves, without actually being prepared to pay the price. Peter has always existed on various teams, and he knows the sacrifices that being on a team truly demands. The team is greater than the individual is just a cliche for people who don't understand sports. For those who do, it's a painful truth because it hurts to live in accordance with it. Submitting to a role you don't want, doing a crap job in silence, playing on defense instead of getting to score goals and be the star. When you can accept the worst aspects of your teammates because you love the collective, that's when you're a team player. And it was Soon who taught him that. He stares at the space on the forms where Soon has to sign his name, so absorbed in his thoughts that he jumps when the phone rings. When he sees that it's a Canadian number, he smiles as he answers, Brian the Butcher, how are you, you old rogue? Pete, his former teammate exclaims at the other end. They played in the farm team league together. Brian never made it all the way to the NHL as a player, but became a scout instead. Now he identifies the most talented teenagers for one of the best teams in the league. Every summer, when he hands in his report ahead of the NHL draft, he fulfills and crushes lifelong dreams the whole world over. So he isn't just calling for Peter's sake. How's the family? Good, good, Brian. How about yours? Oh, you know, the divorce went through last month. Shit, I'm sorry. Don't be, Pete. I've got more time for golf now. Peter laughs half-heartedly. For a few years over in Canada, Brian was his best friend. His wife was close to Kira, and the children used to play together. They still call each other, but at some point they started to talk less and less about each other's lives. In the end, there was only hockey left. Peter is about to ask, are you okay? But doesn't have time because Brian has already exclaimed, how's your boy getting on? Peter takes a deep breath and nods. Kevin? Fantastic, really great. They won the semifinal. He's been brilliant. So I won't regret it if I tell my people to include him in the draft? Peter's heart starts to beat faster. Seriously? You're thinking of drafting him? If you can promise me that we won't be making a mistake. I trust you, Pete. Peter has never been more serious when he replies. I can promise you that you'll be getting a fantastic player. And he's the right sort of guy? Peter nods hard because he knows what that means. Drafting one player instead of another is an immense financial investment for an NHL team. They take absolutely everything into account. It's no longer enough just to be good on the ice. They don't want any unpleasant surprises from the player's private life either. Peter knows it shouldn't be like that, but those are the rules of the game these days. A few years ago, he heard about a hugely talented youngster who slid down the draft because the scouts found out his dad was an alcoholic with a criminal record. That was enough to scare them off, because they had no way of knowing how the teenager would behave if he became a hockey millionaire overnight. So Peter tells the truth, a truth he knows Brian wants to hear. Kevin is the right sort of guy. He gets top grades in school. He comes from a stable family, well brought up. There are definitely no off-ice problems. Brian murmurs happily at the other end. Good, good. And he wears the same number you used to wear, right? Number 9? Yes. I thought they'd have retired that number and hung it from the rafters. Peter grins. They will. Only it'll have Kevin's name on it when they do. Brian laughs loudly. They hang up with a promise to be in touch again soon. That Peter will go over to Canada with his family, that the children will get to see each other again. They both know it will never happen. Amit is gathering up the pucks and cones after practice. Not because anyone's told him to, but because it comes naturally to him, and because it gives him a chance to avoid the others. He's expecting the locker room to be empty when he gets there, but is met by Bobo and Kevin. The two 17-year-olds are picking scraps of tape from the floor and throwing them in the garbage. Amit stands in the doorway and is amazed at how easy it is, the bit that comes next. Kevin says it as if it were the most natural thing in the world. Lit has borrowed his dad's car. Let's go to Head and catch a film. Bobo slaps Ahmet happily on the back. Didn't I say? You're one of us now. 20 minutes later, they're sitting in the car. Ahmet realizes he's sitting in Benji's place, but doesn't ask. Lit is boasting about a blowjob again. Kevin asks Bobo to tell some jokes, and Bobo is so excited to be asked that he snorts coke out of his nose all over the car seat, infuriating Lit. They roar with laughter. Talk about the final, about the long bus trip to the city where it's going to be taking place, about girls and parties, and how things are going to be when they're all playing in the A-team. Ahmet slides into the conversation, at first reluctantly, then with a wonderful warm feeling of being allowed to belong to something. Because that's much easier. Even in Head, people recognize them, and they get slaps on the back and congratulations. After the movie, when Ahmet thinks they're on the way home, Lit turns off the main road just after the Beartown sign. He stops by the lake. Ahmet doesn't understand why until Kevin opens the trunk of the car. They've got beer, lights, skates, and hockey sticks in the back. They put their woolen hats down to mark the goals. They play hockey on the lake that night, 4 boys, and everything feels simple, as if they were children. Ahmet is amazed at how straightforward it is, staying silent in return for being allowed to join in. Peter throws his rubber ball at the wall again, tries not to look at the resignation forms on the desk, tries not to think about Soon as a person and only as a coach. He knows that's what Soon would want. Club first. The board and sponsors can be assholes. Peter knows that better than anyone, but they only want the same as him and Soon, success for the club. Success demands that we see beyond ourselves. Sometimes Peter has had to keep his mouth shut when the board has demanded new recruitments that he knows are stupid, and then he has had to keep his mouth shut all over again when it turns out he was right. Sometimes he has been instructed only to sign 7-month contracts with players, so that the club won't have to pay their wages during the summer. The players, in turn, sign on as unemployed for the rest of the year and are given public assistance, and every so often Tails provides fake certificates declaring that they've done work placement in his supermarket when they were actually training with the team all summer. Then, when the season starts again, they sign new 7-month contracts. Sometimes you have to skirt around a few moral issues in order to survive financially as a small club. Peter has had to accept that as part of the job. Kira once told him that the club had an unpleasant culture of silence, the sort of thing you find among soldiers and criminals. But sometimes that's what it takes, a culture of silence to foster a culture of winning. Peter has spent more time than any other coach trying to reduce the pack's violence in the stands, as well as their menacing hold over the town, and that's made him a hated figure in the Bearskin. But sometimes even he has trouble working out who the worst hooligans in the Beartown Ice Hockey Club are, the ones with tattoos on their necks, or the ones with neckties. He puts the rubber ball down, picks up a pen from a neatly organized box in his desk drawer, and writes his signature on the line where it says, "Representative of the club" on the resignation form. When Soon signs immediately below, it will officially look like he has resigned of his own accord. But Peter knows what he's done. He's just fired his idol. Lars is standing in David's office, hesitating as long as possible before eventually clearing his throat and asking, "How do you want to punish Benji?" David doesn't look up from his computer screen. "We won't be punishing him." Lars' nails tap the wood of the doorframe with pent-up frustration. "He didn't show up for a training session less than a week before the final. You wouldn't tolerate that from anyone else." David looks up, straight at him, so abruptly that Lars jerks back. "Do you want to win the final?" "Of course!" Lars gasps. "Then let this go. Because I may not be able to guarantee that we're going to win with Benji, but I can damn well guarantee that we won't win without him." Lars leaves the room without further protest. When David is alone, he switches off his computer, sighs deeply, picks up a large marker pen, and goes and gets a puck. He writes 3 large letters on it. Then he drives out to the cemetery. Maya is lying in her bed, slipping so sleeplessly in and out of consciousness that she sometimes thinks she's hallucinating. She's stolen some of her mom's sleeping pills from the bathroom cabinet. Last night, she stood alone with them lined up neatly on the sink and tried to work out how many it would take for her not to have to wake up again. Now, as she blinks up at the ceiling, it's as if she still